Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines. This is your Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Garfield County prosecutors charge a woman with a hate crime for destroying a Back the Blue sign. Murray City pays $152,000 to settle a lawsuit by a woman who says she was pulled over because of her skin color. And a Tribune frontline investigation examines the Utah officers involved in multiple police shootings, a show that seems to be all about civilian police encounters today. Joining me in the studio for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. And good morning, Peyton. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Roger.
Also joining us is Tribune legal affairs reporter Jessica Miller. Good morning and welcome to you, Jessica.
Good morning.
And on the Zoom, we've got news columnist Robert Gerke. Hello, Robert. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Listeners, you can join us with your questions or comments by tweeting to @KCPW or calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Let's start things off today with this investigation by the Tribune and Frontline looking at police shootings, and in particular, officers who have shot at people more than once. Jessica and Peyton, you were both involved in this story, and so I'm not certain who to start with. Maybe one of you could tell us the genesis of this reporting. It's the Tribune. It's also Frontline, which is the PBS documentary series. Yeah, what's the background of how this investigation came to be?
So the Salt Lake Tribune, for a long time now, for more than a decade, has kept an internal database of police shootings. Anytime that we know of that an officer fired their gun at somebody while on duty. For a long time, that was, as I said, just an internal database. And last year in 2020, as there were protests happening and, you know, there was really a spotlight on police use of force and police tactics, Peyton and I decided to expand the database, try to, you know, get more data points and do more data analysis with this database. And around that same time, we ended up meeting a producer who works with Frontline, and they have a local journalism initiative. And so we became a part of that initiative, and so they're helping us expand the database with resources, more staffing, so we can kind of, you know, try to understand these police shootings more than we have in the past.
Okay. And that's part of what happened was this week you had a report that came out that was, I guess, sort of part of the expansion of that database. And the article in the Tribune leads with the fact that most police officers, the vast majority, never fire their gun on the job. But there have been those who have fired more than once. And you described a couple of explanations that have been offered for why some officers may discharge their weapon more than once, and why they may be more likely to shoot than others. And one of the explanations offered by police is that, you know, they may have a more dangerous beat than others. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'll take this one. So when we were talking to police experts for this story, it seemed like a lot of them weren't necessarily surprised by this finding, you know, that police shootings themselves are rare, and yet we found this group of officers here. It accounts for nearly a quarter of all officers who have shot in this 17-year time period that we looked at, you know, had fired more than once. And they were saying that can just kind of be attributed to the fact that some of these officers are assigned more dangerous beats. You know, we have, I think it was 35% of those, you know, repeat shootings that we looked at involved like a SWAT team or some kind of special unit like that. And those are, you know, they are given the like express task to go after, you know, people who they think are violent, you know, and stuff like that. And so it's, you know, you talk to the FOP and they say, of course, these officers are going to be involved in more shootings. You know, their exposure to violent situations are greater than other police officers.
FOP is the Fraternal Order of Police.
Yeah.
So the idea then is that, you know, if you're tracking down gang members or people who are drug dealers, that you're more likely to encounter sort of violent scenarios. I guess the question that I have is that something that you can see aside from the 35, you said 35% of those are involved in the SWAT teams. Is the data comprehensive enough to say that's sort of the reason that this happens?
I don't think so. You know, one of the conclusions that we came to in this story is that there aren't many conclusions. You know, like, there are theories for why this is happening, but as, you know, as we've reported, we are among the only people that tracks this data. And so there's not, you know, much research. There's not, you know, many hard conclusions you can come to. So what we do have are these kind of theories, you know, and we looked into that one and found that, you know, 35-ish% of officers were actually involved in these SWAT and special units.
You brought up the well, actually, Jessica, do you have any comments on that? I mean, on the idea that the data is, I guess, incomplete.
I mean, I think one of the issues with when you're looking at police shootings is that the situations can be very dynamic or they vary so much. And so police are kind of hesitant to even identify these repeat shooters as like a problem, right? Like we've got a couple, two officers in the database who their second shooting was the Trolley Square mass shooting. So the idea that like those two officers were in a second shooting and they stopped someone from killing a bunch of people, like that's not a problem. And so I think that, that obviously there are cases where the officers, you know, there's not a problem that they're in multiple shootings, but I think that there's others or some family members or critics might question whether that's the case for all of them. And maybe some of these have patterns, but a lot of them don't. A lot of them seem pretty random.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that this data set seemed to show from the reporting that I read. I mean, I don't have the data set. I looked at what you guys brought together, but that that these are varied instances. Sheriff Rosie Rivera with Salt Lake County, with Unified Police, described, you know, these disparate situations that occur where a, an officer might have to discharge his or her weapon. And then I guess just going back to the Fraternal Order of Police, who are, you know, they are the representatives of the police almost from a they're advocates for police officers who encounter situations like having discharged their weapon, and they say, oh, you know, maybe it's even a good thing that officers are discharging their weapons, or that it's not a problem that they're discharging their weapons more than once. Peyton, is that an accurate? Yeah, I'm quoting here, or trying to quote Ian Adams, who's the executive director of the Fraternal Order of Police.
Yeah, no, I know where you're going, and Ian had said, you know, Ian has been in a shooting himself, so he, you know, he understands this issue kind of more intimately than, you know, some officers might. And so he was saying, like, should a police officer feel bad that they've been involved in multiple shootings? If, you know, for instance, one of the officers in our database who's fired four times, one of those shootings he actually got shot himself, you know, and he was questioning whether an officer should feel bad for defending themselves in that situation, and argued that actually, you know, we have laws in place and policies, you know, that allow police officers to do just that, because there's this expectation that, you know, while policing can be a dangerous job, you know, an officer is going to get home at night if he can. And so, yeah, he you know, he brought up that point.
One of those officers who has been involved in multiple shootings is someone who's still waiting to see whether or not he's going to face prosecution for the latest incident that he was involved in. And this is Sergeant Tyler Longman with West Valley City Police and the shooting of Michael Chad Breinhold. And Jessica, this is something that occurred while Breinhold was in police custody. Mm-hmm. Can you actually just remind us what happened there?
Yeah, so this is a shooting from 2018. It's still pending with the district attorney. We don't know yet whether he'll file charges or if he's going to find it justified. But essentially what happened is they arrested Chad Breinhold for a DUI, and they brought him to the police station. And he's there for a couple of hours. And at the end of this encounter, there's a kind of scuffle. And one of the officers say that he's got my gun, he's got my gun. Chad has his hands handcuffed behind him. And he says that he reached around and tried to put his hand on the another officer's handgun. And as the officer started yelling that Chad had his gun, this Sergeant Longman comes into the room. He pulls out his gun, he grabs Chad's head, he says, "You're about to die, my friend," and then he shoots him pretty much at point-blank range.
Sort of surprised me that he was handcuffed behind his back. This has drawn a lot of scrutiny. I know we've talked about it on the show before, and again, just before we continue on with this story, because I want to talk about Sergeant Longman's sort of history, do we know what the time frame is for when District Attorney Sim Gill might make a decision on whether or not that shooting was quote-unquote justified?
I think he said recently it'll be in a couple weeks, so I think it should be actually coming pretty soon.
Okay. And then just, you know, on the reporting that you did with Frontline, Sergeant Longman, as I said, was one of those people who has shot multiple people. He shot and killed two other people prior to this, right?
Yeah, that's correct. He started with West Valley Police Force in 2006. His first shooting happened a year later. and then he killed another person a year after that. Both of those shootings were found to be legally justified. And then almost 12 years goes by before this shooting with Chad Reinhold.
And I think that, yeah, right, for families of people who have been you know, who lose someone in an incident that involves this interaction with police, people who are shot by police, they, I guess, was Chad Reinhold's family aware of the fact that that the officer had shot people before, before your reporting came out?
They knew before my reporting came out. The attorney had found out and told them prior to the story coming out. And so I did ask them, like, how, you know, what they thought when they found out. And, you know, you look at that body cam footage, and I think especially for his family, that was very shocking just to watch what happened. And then to add on this idea that this was the third person that this officer had killed, they were just shocked that this person could still be working. Though looking at Sergeant Longman's disciplinary history, he doesn't really have any. He's a sergeant. He's been promoted in his career. We've looked at his disciplinary history, and he hasn't really gotten into much trouble at the police department, but he does have that history of being in multiple shootings.
I feel like can you give us the details on those previous shootings? Is that going too deep into one story?
I can try. I'll see if I can remember all the details.
Okay.
One was in 2007, and he was called up. He was called for backup, actually, for a call of a guy was, like, sleeping in his car at a 7-Eleven, and he was the second officer on scene. The initial officer tried to wake up the person who was sleeping in his car, and the person allegedly pointed a gun at the first officer, so the first officer started firing. And once Longman heard that officer start firing, he started firing through the passenger side, and that person died in that incident. And then a year later, he was called to a domestic. Sergeant Longman was called to a domestic violence situation, and a man had his wife in the street was holding a knife to her neck and was counting down from 10, and the woman, like, kind of arched her head out of the way, and that's when Sergeant Longman shot that man and killed him as well.
Hmm. There is, from your reporting, there is one of you, I guess, spoke with former Salt Lake City Police Chief Chris Burbank, and Chris Burbank has some theories about why an officer who shoots once, that is to say, might be more prone to shoot again. Or that's his theory, is that if an officer has already once on the job discharged their weapon, they might do it. They might be more likely to do it again. Peyton, can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I was the one who spoke with Burbank, and he made this analogy to, it was a right hook. He was like, in a moment of distress, if an officer, you know, uses this type of force, in this case, like a right hook, if it works, you know, they're going to go back to that because they found it works and there's no reason to try something different. And he applied that to using a gun. And it's like he doesn't know if this is happening, but he thinks it's a pretty good theory for why it might be happening.
Hmm.
And our data kind of looked into this issue as well. And we found that many of these officers were in another shooting within 5 years of their first shooting. You know, some were in a shooting, I think, less than a year after, you know. And so it's like there's a general theory in policing that, like, shooting your gun once might make it easier to shoot it again, just because, and Burbank said this, you know, the making the choice to use deadly force against somebody is not an easy choice to make, you know. And so it you know, the build up to that, maybe you don't want to do it or something, but then you fire once and maybe it's easier that second time.
Hmm. Getting past, like, the sort of initial barrier of having I think people understand what we're saying here. This theory, though, is not something that the current chief of police in Salt Lake City holds with. He doesn't think that's an accurate portrayal, as from what I understand in your article.
Yeah, I brought that up to him, and he told me he doesn't think that is true at all. And he pointed to this, I think it was a Pew study from 2017 that just was, it was surveying officers for their opinions, you know, on how they use force after, you know, the police shooting of Michael Brown and Ferguson and stuff like that. You know, like, have these, you know, national events that have brought a lot of scrutiny to policing, have they changed the way you do your jobs? And these officers in this study overwhelmingly said that they would be less likely to use force when, you know, it was appropriate or even necessary because of what happened. So he pointed to that and said, you know, regardless of, you know, if it might be easier to pull the trigger a second time, officers are actually more hesitant to pull the trigger now.
And that's what they're saying in surveys. I guess that in the moment it might be a different scenario, though. I mean, when you're responding to whatever you're responding to. There's, I guess, another sort of aspect of this is traumatic events. And I don't know, I think one of you talked about this in the reporting that, you know, police who are responding to, for example, the Trolley Square shooting in 2007, they've been through something highly traumatic. Does the fact that they have experienced that trauma play into the likelihood or not of an officer using his or her weapon in a future instance? Is that something you can address?
We tried to find out about that, and that's definitely a story we want to pursue. You know, this idea of fear and how it might impact, you know, an officer's personal decision making. You know, Burbank kind of talked about it in this story. He was like, you know, if you are out doing your job and you get shot at, or you encounter mass shooting, you know, or something, you know, and you encounter this violent situation and have to shoot, would that make you more paranoid? Would that make you, you know, more apt to fire your gun? And he said, maybe. But it's like, we would love to explore that issue and plan on it, but haven't really done it in much depth yet.
Jessica, any thoughts on that? I mean, I can also ask you about the data itself. I mean, there's this recurring theme in your reporting that, as you brought up earlier, that the data is kind of incomplete. And I know that Jason Stevenson from ACLU of Utah was decrying the fact that this is incomplete information. We need more data, more robust data. Where does that data come from?
Well, you know, this is a database that the Tribune has created, and the way that we get these data points is basically through our reporting. Like, we file records requests, we get police reports, we watch body cam footage, and then we'll manually enter into our database, you know, was this person, what kind of weapon did this person have? Were they having a mental health crisis at the time? And so we're trying to get all these data points because, I mean, we're doing it because the government isn't. This is not a database that that the state is keeping track of. There's no statewide database, even just to say how many shootings are happening a year, much less some of these, you know, more unique data points. And so until that happens, you know, we're kind of doing this on our own based off of our own reporting.
I think I'm going to bring in the news columnist, Robert Gierke, here for a minute. And Robert is on the Zoom. Robert, this, you know, we're talking about the likelihood or not of police discharging their weapons. I wonder if there's a sort of another part of this conversation that's being left out, which is kind of about America and its gun culture and the fact that sometimes, you know, or it's more likely in a place like the United States of America that a police officer is going to encounter someone with a deadly weapon. Not that the reporting leaves that out, but just out of the conversation so far, you could address that, or you could address the likelihood of police officers shooting, you know, more than once if they've already fired once. I don't know. How do you want to enter the story, Robert?
I think that the reporting that has been done tees up a discussion about, you know, the police shootings in general. I mean, it tees up this whole discussion about, you know, do we need to look more in depth at some of the causes? And I think Peyton and Jessica both hit on, we don't really know exactly what's motivating this or why it might be more frequent that certain officers shoot or don't shoot. You know, I think it's important reporting because it's accountability journalism for one thing. I mean, it's bringing this information to light, and it took them a lot of work to do it. I know how long they've been working on this. And so, but there's also this problem with it where there's this sort of randomness to it. I mean, one of the shootings they highlight is, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the individual who was driving through Salt Lake City and shooting out of the car.
Then
multiple officers shot and killed this individual. You know, that's one where you kind of where it's completely random. But then if those officers are later involved in other shootings, then you can start to, you know, dig deeper into the questions of why and if there's a pattern that's forming here. So, I mean, I think it's important, and I think it does tee up a discussion about police shootings generally, and also kind of sets up a longer term reporting to see, you know, to follow some of these cases through, and it's valuable, I believe, to our readers in the community.
Jessica or Peyton, is there a sort of general response? I mean, Jessica, maybe I'll ask you this because you've both been covering criminal justice for a while, but I'm wondering about the sort of trajectory of how the police are thinking about their interactions with the community. I know there's been a lot of focus on, you know, de-escalation, and some of the cases that you cite in your reporting are about, there's Giovanni Mercato, for example, who was experiencing, he was schizophrenic, and the police shot him because, well, maybe you can tell that story and then sort of broadly talk about how the trend of how police are thinking about the way in which they engage with the community, and how whether or not they draw their weapon is something that they're that they're more likely to do now or less likely to do now. I'm not certain what the question here is. I know that there's the survey that Peyton brought up about in the wake of the Michael Brown shooting, that a lot of officers report not wanting to do this anymore. But is there a concerted focus on training right now?
I think I might be the best one to take that question.
Peyton, please, yeah.
So I guess to start off, so sort of the broad outline of what happened when Giovanni Mercato was killed. I think it was in 2019. He was in, you know, some kind of mental distress that night. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and his family said that when he was having an episode like he was that night, he gets easily confused. He's kind of apt to wander, and they actually have, and this becomes important later on, but they actually have sort of surveillance cameras all around their house. And so they, you know, went back and watched the footage, and they could see him, you know, talking to people who weren't there, you know, crying. He was obviously in some kind of distress. And so apparently he gets a knife. He walks over to a nearby party that's happening. You know, the partygoers, you know, are kind of, you know, they're not happy that he is there because he's, you know, he's not really talking to anybody. He's kind of catatonic, and he has a knife in his hand. So police gets called. By that point, you know, Giovanni has gone back to his home. And so when the officers arrive, there's four or five officers were there. And Giovanni's just walking out of his own, you know, yard in his own carport, and he has a knife in his hand. He's kind of walking slowly, and the officers are telling him, you know, quit walking towards us, stop, freeze, you know, drop the knife. And he doesn't, and, you know, he gets within X amount of feet of them, and they fire and kill him. And, you know, the family has since filed a civil lawsuit in this case, saying that, you know, Giovanni was on his own property. He had a knife, but he was far enough away from officers that he probably, you know, couldn't do any damage. They don't think the police should have fired. But, you know, this kind of gets into that question that you're talking about, is like, are police thinking any differently about when they use force or not? And, you know, Chief Brown with Salt Lake City PD seems to think so. And I've spent a lot of time at police training as I've been reporting this project. And, you know, this wasn't included in the story, but when I'm there, it does seem like the trainers are trying to instill in, you know, the recruits an idea of, like, if you decide to shoot, you know, make sure you have a good reason for it. You know, like, we had brought up that case with Sergeant Longman, one of his first shootings, where he began to shoot because he heard another officer shooting. And, like, in training, the trainers would say, you know, don't just shoot because somebody else is shooting. You know, like, you need to register this threat. You need to do that, too. And don't. And they also spoke about not putting yourselves in situations that you don't need to put yourself in. You don't put yourself in dangerous situations if you don't need to, where it might lead to a shooting. You know, so they are thinking about this, yeah.
And that's very central to the idea of de-escalation as well, that if you show up on a, I guess, at a scene where something is happening and you're responding to it, and you know, somebody's antagonizing you, egging you on, it could escalate, and the idea is to try and prevent that from happening. Jessica, I mean, there's a lot of places we could go, or Peyton, I think that we're going to have to head to a break here pretty soon, but we mentioned at the outset that this was reporting that the Tribune did in conjunction with PBS Frontline. Is a video format, you know, documentary coming out on this at some point?
Yes, yeah, we've been working with them, filming a documentary about police shootings in Utah. That will be coming soon. We don't have an exact date yet, but I'm guessing sometime this fall.
Okay. And then we're going to head to a break, but anything else that you'd like to add about the reporting? I'll encourage people to go check it out at sltrip.com, a breakdown of Utah. The headline is "Most Never Shoot at Someone, But These 38 Utah Officers Have Pulled the Trigger Multiple Times." Check that out at sltrip.com. Anything else to add before we head to a break?
I'm good.
Okay. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to head to our first break in the show, and when we come back, more from this past week in Utah news.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Peyton Harkins, Jessica Miller, and Robert Gerke. It is our live Friday morning Utah News Review. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting to @KCPW. Again, the show is heavy on police-civilian encounters, and on that front, let's turn now to the story of a hate crime being filed in one of those interactions. Peyton Harkins, this stems from a traffic stop in Garfield County. Maybe you can just tell us what happened in that traffic stop. This has to do with the destruction of a sign. Lay it out for us.
Yeah, so this happened July 7th. Apparently, a group of people, they were traveling through Panguitch. A police officer there with the Garfield County Sheriff's Office sees them, believes they're speeding. Apparently, they're going 50 in a 30 miles per hour zone. So he pulled them over at this was like a gas station. And so he talks, you know, to the drivers of these cars. It's apparently a caravan of about three cars. So, you know, there's a bunch of people who were here. And he talks to them, decides not to give the drivers a ticket, and says that he's just going to let them on his way. But then a group of people who are with this group that got pulled over, who had apparently like briefly walked away during this interaction with police, they come back, and one of them has a Back the Blue sign now. And it's this 19-year-old woman who we learn is from California. And the officer says that, you know, she walks up with the sign, she crumples it, stomps on it, and throws it in the trash can. And all the while is looking at her with this, like, intimidating look on her face, he says. And so he ends up arresting her because he doesn't believe that this sign is hers. He thinks it's a sign that's apparently all around this town of Panguitch, you know, in people's yards and stuff like that. So he thinks it's one of those signs and that she, you know, destroyed somebody else's property, so which is a criminal mischief in his eyes. And then they enhance it to a hate crime because they say that she destroyed this property with the intention of intimidating this police officer for being a police officer.
Hate crime. What is Utah hate crime statute about? How do we define what represents a hate crime in Utah?
That's a good question. There are sort of two statutes in Utah that talk about hate crimes. There is this one that we've had for a while that critics of it for a long time said it was basically unenforceable, you know. Salt Lake County Prosecutor Sim Gill is one of those people. And basically, you have to prove that somebody who is doing the crime meant to violate, I think it's a constitutionally protected right of somebody. And so for the longest time, you know, Sim Gill and others said they weren't able to file hate crimes against in cases where it just seemed obviously like a hate crime. Like there's one in Salt Lake City where somebody, you know, attacked somebody who is Hispanic, you know, and was yelling anti-Hispanic slurs, and they couldn't file that case. And then there's another one that actually became a law after the 2019 or during the 2019 session.
Right. This is recent. I mean, a recent mm-hmm. addition to state statute. I understand that the ACLU of Utah denounced the idea that this was, denounced the filing of this hate crime. What did they say?
Yeah, so they you know, this hate crime filing had drawn a lot of sort of, you know, attention and outrage from people across the nation, but this was among the first people I saw in Utah who actually spoke out against it. And they were saying that, you know, filing this sort of enhancement, which makes, you know, a Class B misdemeanor now a Class A misdemeanor, which means this person, if convicted, could spend 1 year in jail. You know, they said that this was, you know, this would have the effect of having, like, a chilling effect on people. They would begin to get the message that if they are anti-law enforcement and break the law, they could face additional penalties.
If I remember correctly from your reporting, I'm just blanking on this now, Peyton, but was ACLU of Utah, you know, this is the American Civil Liberties Union of Utah, were they opposed to the hate crimes law that passed in 2019?
They were, yeah, and they are sort of against all sorts of laws that would increase penalties for people based on, you know, like hate crime enhancements or gang enhancements. They're against all of those because they believe that they will just be used as an excuse to further marginalize already marginalized groups for having messages or opinions that they don't agree with. And they say that's actually what happened in this case.
Meanwhile, Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill and others, I mean, prosecutors say this is a valuable tool. And I mean, did, for example, Sim Gill weigh in on whether or not this should be charged as a hate crime? And it's singling out a specific group, in this instance, police?
Yeah, he wouldn't comment on this specific case. But, I mean, he did comment on just the value of this hate crime statute that he'd been, you know, helping to fight for years. And, you know, he just said that basically when a hate crime occurs, the intention is not just to, you know, hurt whoever the victim is in that instance, but it's to send sort of this, again, this idea of this chilling message, you know, it's to send a message to everybody that's a part of this group and further, and, you know, traumatize or terrorize them.
This isn't the first instance in which prosecutors in Garfield County have charged someone with a hate crime for almost for a very similar reason. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I knew about this, but I had sort of forgotten until this happened again. But it was a very similar situation where somebody's in, I can't remember if it was Panguitch or just somewhere in Garfield County, but they were there. They too encounter one of these back the blue signs, and they got some spray paint and basically spray painted over the word blue in that sign and wrote bisexual. And then they were, you know, arrested. It's the same charge that this woman got, which is a class A misdemeanor for criminal mischief.
And it was also, I mean, that was a hate crime to have defaced the sign. I mean, in the eyes of the prosecutors.
Yeah.
It seems like I don't know, maybe I should bring in the columnist on this. In the one instance, part of the sort of justification for the hate crime was the crumpling up and the, you know, menacing the officer in question. Was the other one in an instance where they were directing it at a specific officer or anything like that?
I don't think it was because...
Oh, sorry, Gerke. Hold on, let me get Peyton's response, then I'll come to you, Robert. Hold on.
Yeah, so this one, it wasn't that they were, you know, intending their message to go to a specific police officer, but it was a piece of property that wasn't theirs that they, you know, destroyed or defaced with an anti-police message. So they extrapolated from that.
Okay. And then, yeah, Robert Gerke, let's bring you into the conversation on the Zoom. Visual cues are hard because we don't have you on the video here, but the difference between those, I mean, is there, I know you wrote about this in a column that just posted this morning about this most recent example, and your argument is that it shouldn't be classified as a hate crime, right?
Right. I mean, Peyton touched on the language of the statute, and when you're talking about intimidating or terrorizing somebody, it also requires, the statute says it has to deprive them of freely exercising constitutional or legal right. And it's hard to see in the current case in Garfield County how this deputy was deprived of exercising or enjoying a constitutional or legal right. You know, you could. So it doesn't really fit the letter of the law, but it also kind of goes against the spirit of the law. The spirit of the law this wasn't targeting a group of people. It didn't, you know, terrorize a group of people the way that we normally think of hate crimes, you know, doing. And so it seems like this prosecutor in Garfield County, I mean, the deputy, it appears, overreacted, and this young woman ended up spending a night in jail. And obviously is facing much more severe consequences potentially. But it feels to me like this prosecutor completely overreacted. Prosecutors are given discretion to exercise judgment in cases like this. And it appears that this prosecutor, Barry Huntington, did not exercise good judgment, and it actually abused the power that he's entrusted with.
Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Tribune, and some opinions there. Peyton, just going back to the fact that, is it the same prosecutor who filed the previous hate crime on the back the blue defaced, you know, sign being defaced? Oh, wait, hold on. There you are.
I actually don't know that.
Okay. In that previous instance, though, part of what the person who defaced the sign had to do was apologize, right?
Yeah, they were sentenced to... It was actually 1 year in jail, but as part of like a suspended sentence, they only were ordered to 2 days in jail, had to pay some kind of fine, and then they had to write this apology letter, which is actually available, and I bought it on the state court's website, and you can kind of read through what they, you know, what they sort of thought about what happened to them. And I mean, yeah, they seemed very apologetic for what had happened.
Okay. And then, Robert Gerke, I just want to quickly bring up the idea, though, that the hate crime statute is about crimes that target a specific group, and in this instance, it's the police. Does it matter who the group is when you talk about a specific group when we talk about the hate crimes statute in Utah?
So, yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I like, frankly, about Utah's current hate crimes law is that it's open-ended, and it doesn't necessarily just protect, underserved communities, minority communities, and so forth in the state. It's open-ended, so it can apply to, say, religious people, regardless of their religion, whether they're Muslim or Mormon. It can apply to, ethnic groups, whether they're Latino or white. If they're targeted for a crime based on, based on their traits, it can be an enhancement. And it's one of the things I like about it. It's not trying to single groups out and name all of the groups, or because we all have a gender, we all have a race, we all have these traits. And so it's one of the things I like about it. And certainly police officers could be protected, I would think. It's based on more on, an occupation, I guess, which may or may not fit the bill. But as Peyton mentioned, there's also a targeting element to it. So it could be applicable, but it strikes me that in this case, it just doesn't fit again, the spirit or the letter of the law. There's potential, I guess, that the legislature could look at this and think that maybe it needs to be tightened up some. I kind of doubt that that's going to happen. I think they feel like they've got it where they want it, and I don't know that they're necessarily going to be outraged by the fact that it's being applied in this case to, sure, to a police officer.
Yeah, and it took quite a while, as I recall, for the hate crime statute to pass the legislature. So it would require a lot of coordination there. Peyton, anything to add on this story before we move on to other reporting by Jessica Miller?
The only thing I would say is that the Garfield County Sheriff did respond to some of this outrage recently.
Yeah.
He sent out a statement just basically, defending his officer and defending the hate crime charge. And, he kind of painted his officer as doing his job, compassionately and professionally, and this teenager as, singling him out and, verbally attacking him and intimidating him just because he was a law enforcement officer. So, yeah, I think it's important to hear what the police have to say about it, too.
Yeah. It's interesting, the targeting aspect that Robert Gerke brought up just a minute ago. I mean, it seems, again, just going back to that previous case, like there was less of that potential targeting as it seemed sort of amorphous, or, it was, wasn't necessarily directed at any individual officer or the police in general. But I guess the defacing of the sign. Sorry, that's I don't mean to like open a can of worms right now, but Peyton, thank you for your reporting on this. And a reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is @KCPW. And Jessica Miller, we're not yet done with reporting on police interactions because this week you reported on Murray City, the city of Murray, settling a lawsuit, or agreeing to settle a lawsuit, I should say, they're paying to settle out of court in a case involving a woman who was pulled over in Murray. Maybe just tell us what this lawsuit is about and why it was filed.
Yeah, this was a lawsuit that was filed last year by a woman named Donna Miller. She was pulled over by a Murray police officer in 2018, and there's kind of, two versions of this story. She says that she didn't do anything wrong when she was pulled over. The officer said that she didn't have valid insurance, and so when she showed her insurance, he said, you seem like you're driving impaired, and so he made her go through, sobriety test after sobriety test. She doesn't drink alcohol. She doesn't do drugs, so The field breathalyzer tests were negative, but the officer said that she didn't pass those tests you do where you walk around the tests that they do, and so she was arrested and they brought her to the police department where she underwent a couple more hours of these type of testing. She actually was charged with a DUI even though there was no proof with her blood alcohol level that she had consumed any drugs or alcohol. Eventually, that charge was dropped after the test results came back that she wasn't under the influence. So that's kind of the basis of the traffic stop. The officer says that she'd been driving erratically in and out of lanes, and that's why he pulled her over. And the city says that it was reasonable that he did that. And, you know, even though they're settling, they do not admit any sort of wrongdoing.
Why are they? And what is? I mean, she's claiming that she was profiled, that she was pulled over because of the color of her skin, right?
Exactly. Yeah, she said that she didn't do anything wrong. The only thing that she did was driving while black. That's how she phrased it.
And so, yeah, I guess how did the settlement come to be? It's intriguing. I mean, is there evidence, you know, on one side or the other that says this is why she was pulled over, this is why she wasn't pulled over?
Well, like I mentioned, there's these kind of two version of events, right? And so, of course, the best way to see what the truth is to have evidence. And in this case, the officer did not have a body camera footage. He didn't have his body camera on because he was on his way to work and the body camera was charging at his office. And so there was like some dash cam video, but it didn't capture the initial interaction. And so it essentially becomes like a he said, she said case. And the city acknowledges that not having body camera footage in this, you know, day and age where everyone's wearing body cam most of the time is problematic, and it causes doubt with the public. So they thought that this was the better route to settle it. But again, they say they didn't do anything wrong. They didn't admit wrongdoing, but it was their way to settle the case and not continue litigation.
Just not go to court, I guess.
Exactly.
And just quickly, Miller, the woman who was pulled over and who was involved in this lawsuit, she came here to go to school. I mean, she was on her way to class, right, when she was pulled over? Is that, yeah,
that's correct. I can't remember exactly where she lived before this, but she is a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and they were promoting a nursing program, I believe. And so she was in Utah because she was going to school because of this, you know, LDS church connection. And that's what she was doing on the day that she was pulled over.
Okay. I'm going to forego bringing in, unless there's anything else to add to this story, I'm gonna skip the news columns for now because we do need to head to another break in the show and then come back with one final story that we'll try and cover relatively quickly before we turn to our underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Peyton Harkins, Jessica Miller, and Robert Gerke. This show is our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio with reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Again, you can call us 801-355-TALK to join this conversation or tweet to @KCPW. Earlier in the show, we had a conversation about symbols and hate, a hate crime charge for someone who destroyed a Back the Blue sign. There was a story from last week that spilled into this past weekend that was about a symbol and about racism, a different story altogether, really, than the last one we were just talking about. But the most recent reporting on this was by Eric Walden, and since he's not here, I will ask you, Peyton Harkins, to just lay this out for us. This is the story about the most recent story is that the NAACP of Utah rejected a statement made by the founder of Black Lives Matter Utah. Would you mind explaining that for us, Peyton?
Yes. So Lex Scott, who is the leader of Black Lives Matter Utah, has a, you know, a Facebook page where people can, you know, kind of get together and share news and kind of talk about current events. And on July 4th, you know, 4th of July, Independence Day, she posted a what do you call it on Facebook? She posted a post.
Yeah.
And she basically said that she was responding to this group of like far right nationalists who were marching somewhere on the East Coast with an American flag. And she was saying that, like, when she sees an American flag and when a lot of people in her group sees an American flag, they see a symbol of hatred and they believe the people who are flying it, you know, proudly are racist. And, you know, that post garnered a lot of, you know, comments and shares and stuff like that. We ended up picking up that story basically just trying to, like, you know, explain what Lex Scott was saying and also, you know, get response to it. And a lot of people, you know, here and elsewhere, you know, they did take sort of offense to this idea that the American flag is racist. But, you know, Lex said, you know, when we go out and we're protesting, you know, for Black lives or against police violence, it seems like a lot of our detractors who show up to counter protest are carrying American flags. And so I have come, you know, to see these flags as a symbol, you know, of, you know, the anti of what we stand for.
And it drew a lot of national attention, a lot of blowback. I mean, TV personalities saying this is wrong. But it also locally, the more recent story is that I guess as a result of the whole conversation happening, the NAACP of Utah and Janetta Williams, who is the executive director, I think is the title, I'm not certain, of said this is not, we don't agree with the statement, right?
Yeah, so a few days later, and that's what Eric's story is about, is when the NAACP came out and basically said that they reject this idea that the American flag is racist. You know, they said that, you know, it stands for all people, and in America, you know, it stands for equality and justice for all. It's sort of, you know, regardless of the situation on the ground for Black Americans, you know, which she acknowledges, you know, there is racism, you know, we have not reached equity. You know, this American flag is aspirational. It stands for what America could be.
Hmm. Just because I opened up a giant topic with very little time left in the show. I'm going to bring Robert Gierke, the news columnist, in on this one. And Robert, I mean, I don't know even what to ask you here. The statements by Black Lives Matter Utah, and then the response from the NAACP of Utah, it underscores obviously a lot of the conversation that we've been having in this country for the past year and a half, and longer, of course, about racism and institutional inherent racism in the United States. How do you want to tackle this?
Well, I mean, I understand what Lex was conveying. The flag, if we take the flag to be a symbol of our country, it's a symbol both, as Peyton said, that Janetta was focusing on an aspirational symbol, but it also represents our past. And you know, depending on who you are, you're going to view that differently. We have racism in this country, and we have racism in our past. And if the flag embodies our country, it embodies all of the complex history. So I understand where Lex is coming from. Obviously, this is going to upset a lot of people when you articulate it that way, because there are a lot of people in this country who, you know, revere the flag. And so, you know, I'm not surprised that it turned into a national story and that people were outraged by it. But, you know, it's also probably not, it kind of also reflects, I think, the division in the Black activist community between the sort of old guard NAACP and the more proactive, more progressive Black Lives Matter movement. So there's a lot of things tied up in this, and you know, I think obviously part of it is that people can view the same symbol and see different things, and that kind of goes without saying.
Sure. Again, I opened up a big topic without giving it enough time for us to talk about, and maybe we can do it at a future show. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there and turn to our final segment, Underplayed Stories of the Week, with not a ton of time to do it. Peyton Harkins, do you want to kick us off with a pick for Underplayed Story of the Week?
Sure. I would like to throw out the story by Becky Jacobs today. She's our women's issues reporter. And she, as part of this sort of ongoing series that she's been doing on, you know, the status of women in the state, did a profile on Esther Peterson. She was born Provo in 1906, has served under three U.S. presidents. And it was cool to find out that if I look, you know, in my kitchen pantry, I can kind of see the results of her work at the national level.
Wow. Cool. Check that out at sltrib.com. A really interesting story that I just saw this morning and was intrigued by, but I'll dig further into it. Jessica Miller, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
So a few of our reporters have been working on stories about people experiencing homelessness outside of Salt Lake County. And this week there was a photo essay that was published about people in Moab experiencing homelessness. And I think seeing those photos and seeing their stories was a really interesting and unique perspective.
I thought it was the photo essay that, I mean, the photos that accompany it are really incredible and great reporting by Bethany Rogers and Taylor Stevens, I think, from Moab. Great. Check that out, sltrib.com. Robert Gierke, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Both of the picks that Jessica and Peyton had are terrific. I'm going to go with a piece Andy Larson did about breakthrough cases. Andy's obviously been doing these COVID explainers throughout the pandemic. His latest one is about the recent rise in breakthrough cases, and I think it gives readers an opportunity to kind of get informed and empowered by knowing the data. So check it out.
Check that out at sltrib.com as well. I'm going to go with a story by also Taylor Stevens about three women who found out that they were all dating the same man and who then decided to get in a bus together, minus their, you know, now ex, their mutual ex-boyfriend, and travel around the West. I just kind of found it to be a charming story. Check it out as well at sltrib.com. Jessica Miller, Peyton Harkins, Robert Gricke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. That does it for Behind the Headlines, which is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we are taking a break on the show for the Pioneer Day holiday, but join us again the week after. And yeah, stay cool out there. Join us again next, not next week, the week after here on KCPW. Thanks again for listening.